Hi, this is Debbie Mayer in Hudson, and you're listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 on your radio dial or streaming 24/7 at WGXC.org.
Moments before he's hit with a 40-foot wall of sulfuric acid that will horribly burn everything in its path. Now, that's real acid, so I want to see goggles, people.
My eyes, the goggles do nothing.
It's almost always safety first at the Thingularity Radio Program, so don't let that happen to you. Have your questions answered by sending them to CatskillMakersInfo@gmail.com and tune in every first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM Acra or anytime at WGXC.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Christine Boak of Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Hello, and welcome to the Thingularity Radio Program, broadcasting live from the Automotive Division of the Catskill Makers Syndicate at 65 West Bridge Street here in Catskill. We are here to answer any science or technology-related questions you may have. Contact us at CatskillMakersInfo@gmail.com, or you can also contact us directly at www.thingularity.tech. That is thingularity.tech. That will give you access to us directly, and we'll be able to answer any questions that you may have. Okay, now we're introducing ourselves. This is the Catskill Makers.
Oh, I'm Sam.
I'm Cody.
Albert.
Chill.
Corey.
And we are introducing our special guest today, Herman the Crazy Russian, hailing from Sullivan County. Say hello.
How you doing, everyone?
How are ya? Okay. Now, does anybody have any questions for Herman? Herman, what have you been up to?
Well, in February of this year, I started a Craigslist project. And what I'm doing is I do free automotive repair for people who are in need. People who are lower income, elderly, people who are disabled. Basically, anyone who needs auto repair and can't afford to fix their car.
Nice. That's very cool. All right.
Do you work out of your garage or you have a shop somewhere? Or?
I work for a gentleman. He's the owner of the shop. I approached him about this project, and he was kind enough to allow me to do so in his shop. I have the keys to the shop. I can, you know, do it after hours, on my own days off, stuff like that. So he was very kind, you know, to allow me to do so, because if you can imagine, there's insurance involved, there's liability, there's all sorts of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we're bringing people in who are not our customers. These are strangers from the outside, so we have to be a little bit careful how we approach it.
Would you like to mention who he is, since he's been so kind to help out?
His name is David Greco.
Nice. And that's the name of his business?
I don't want to put the name of the business out there, if you don't mind.
No problem. No problem whatsoever. Okay. So, what kind of repairs have you had to do recently? Anything interesting?
I mean, you know, it's everything. It's the gamut of auto repair. In terms of the free stuff, I don't take on anything major. I don't take on big projects because it's something that I have to accomplish in one night. So the shop is a regular operating shop. I can't have the vehicle stay overnight until the next day. So whatever it is, it has to be done in a couple hours, which leads to things like brake jobs, basic stuff, belts, light bulbs. The biggest thing I've done so far probably was doing an actuator motor in a dashboard for a gentleman. He was driving around. He's disabled. He was driving around with no heat for last winter. He took this car. He has a minivan. He took it to a Chrysler dealership, and they quoted him at $800 to replace the actuator.
Ouch.
And so on. So I was able to do it for him for free. He bought the actuator himself.
And the actuator, that does what?
The actuator opens and closes little doors that you have underneath your dash, which allows your HVAC to work properly, allows heat or AC to come out of your vents.
So it's just a solenoid replacement?
It's not a solenoid. It's kind of a solenoid, yeah. It's a stepper motor, technically.
Oh, so, really?
But the problem is that the location of this stepper motor is behind and underneath the dashboard, so you have to take the dashboard out.
Very deep.
It. Yes. Mm.
Yep. Gotcha. Very cool. Very cool. And now that was donated. Now, did he have to get the motor?
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of the things that the way I set it up is you bring your own parts, and I'm providing the labor for free.
Awesome.
So, but sometimes I do come across people who are really needy, and I've bought parts with my own money already. And what's nice about this, which it's actually not nice, it's amazing. I've had people contact me, and they've offered their credit card numbers to pay for somebody else's parts, which is, I think, is like really cool. So it's not someone, obviously, it's just random strangers. They see my ad, and they offer their own way to help.
That's really excellent.
Recently, someone actually donated a car to me. So this was pretty interesting, too. No one ever gave me a car before, and there's a younger guy. He got this car. He did a job for somebody. The man couldn't pay him, so he traded the car, you know, as payment for his labor. He wasn't able to put the car back on the road. It has a bad motor, so he decided to donate it to me. It just happens to be a Mercedes-Benz.
Nice.
Nice.
It's kind of cool. I used to work for Mercedes-Benz for the dealership back in Brooklyn. And what's nice, too, about this car is when I was working at the dealership, I saw these cars coming in on a regular basis for service, so I'm familiar with this make and model. So now I'm not sure if I'm going to fix it or I'm just going to sell it, but whatever I make off the sale of this car is going to go towards this project, of course.
Nice. Excellent. And if anybody listening feels like contributing or helping out in any way, you can contact us at CatskillMakersInfo@gmail.com, and we'll put you in touch with Herman.
And there's other ways too, like the way that I found them, which is Craigslist. But it was under the free area, but now it's in the Hudson Valley one.
It's in Hudson Valley paid automotive services, but within the next couple of days, it will be also relisted on the free in Catskills and in Hudson Valley.
Okay.
I relist them usually in both of those areas, in Hudson Valley and Catskills, since these are the closest areas to the shop.
Now, what inspired you to start doing this?
It's kind of a personal story. It's comes from my own hardship that I had. I don't want to get too far into it, but I'll just say briefly, several years ago, I was arrested. I went through a legal justice system. All the charges against me were dismissed because the police unlawfully and illegally arrested me. They actually stole my vehicle. They stole my car. And so for about 4 years, I was struggling without a vehicle.
Was that seized under civil forfeiture?
It's not. No. It was just taken from the scene, the so-called scene. It was towed to a private facility, a private yard, which was illegal for them to do so.
Mm-hmm,
there was
yep.
no judge's warrant. There was no. There was nothing. There was no paperwork. They just decided that they're going to steal my car. This is something that they've been doing in the county that which I reside. This is a common practice that they do.
Not just yours, from what I hear.
Right. And so, as a result of this, I just thought about how can I help? Because I knew that I wasn't the only one this happened to, and I knew there was other people in this situation. And obviously, in these rural areas where we live, there's no public transport, so it's very difficult to get around. And once you don't have a car, now you're relying on your friends, your neighbors, your family to give you rides.
Yeah, Uber and Lyft aren't exactly everywhere.
Right, right. Or maybe someday they will be up here, and even if they are, you know, it's not accessible for everyone. So I thought, how can I help in my local community? How can I provide a service that will actually really help the local people? So actually, when I first started this initially, I just opened it for Sullivan County residents, as I wanted to just stay in that area and just help the local population. But immediately, as soon as I put the post up, people were contacting me from Hudson Valley, from other areas, and I could see they needed help. So more than probably, I think after the first month, I opened it up to just anyone. I took, if you're only a Sullivan County resident, out of the ad, so now it's just open to anyone. Whoever wants to show up, they're more than welcome to. And I have people calling me from Pennsylvania, from New Jersey, from the city. It's just that obviously we're, because of the distance, not everyone is going to drive that far, even when it comes for free labor.
Yeah, I mean, how are they going to get their lemons to you for you to make the lemonade?
That's right.
Well, maybe there's some inspiration to be spread around here, and some other people can take up the mantle.
That would be wonderful. I would love to see that. I'd love to see other people joining me and doing the same thing in their own local communities.
More than just, you know, fixing your aunt's brake job for her, helping out. Yep. We like to do that here at the Makers. People come down all the time. They have questions or projects they need to work on. There was a gentleman in today that needed to work on an LED display with some weird random software issue. Came in, we did what we could, and, you know, can't ask for much more.
He came out with a little bit more knowledge.
Yeah.
Which is like,
you know, we'll educate you a little if we can't directly help you. So that's great. That's really good.
So did you ever have any bad experiences with this charitable work that you're doing?
I don't want to say I've had bad experience, but I will say that I think someone did use me, someone that didn't need my services. They had money. That was one case. And really, I don't want to say a bad experience, because when I started this, I thought about it, that at some point, someone will come along who will either cheat me somehow or someone who doesn't really need my help.
Bound to happen.
It's bound to happen. So the way I looked at it, it's their problem. It has nothing to do with me. Mm-hmm. What I'm doing is I'm putting myself out there. I'm being honest. So if somebody wants to cheat me, let them be a lowlife in their life. And that's why I put that kind of in the ad also, to kind of screen people from sort of taking advantage of me. I have a bunch of Q&A in the ad. This way, it's kind of a pre-screening for some people. For example, I have... one of the things is I will not go to your place and fix your car. I'm not going to come to your house, to
smart.
Your garage.
Very smart.
Actually, I learned it's incredible that it's illegal to do so, from my understanding. In the state of New York, you're not allowed to work, not even on your friend's or your neighbor's car, in their own garage.
That's remarkable.
Yeah, it is. You have to be a registered motor vehicle repair shop to do repairs on motor vehicles. So you can't work out of your house, technically. Another thing I put in is that the vehicle has to be roadworthy. It has to be insured. It has to be registered. It has to be on the road. In other words, I don't want vehicles that are dead in somebody's yard. That person wants to tow it in. And then the reason for that is I don't want a car to get stuck in the shop. I want to help people. I don't want to take your car, have it sitting in the shop. And let's say you can't come up with the parts, and then it becomes like a... You know, it's an inconvenient situation.
A stretched out nightmare.
For both of us, for me and for you as a customer. In fact, I want to mention I did have that happen one time. I set this up with these questions initially, you know, when I first started it. And as more and more people started contacting me, I sort of made a mistake to start accepting more and more. So I did go to one woman's house to try to help her with a car, and I quickly realized that that was a mistake. And one time I did allow one gentleman to tow his car in with a brake problem, which turned into, I think, a 2 months journey. We fixed his car, but because he was poor, he couldn't come.
In my line of work, we call that a bonus round.
Right, right. So he couldn't afford to pay for his parts, unfortunately. And it was only, I think it was like $200 worth of parts. It wasn't a big figure, but he was struggling legitimately.
Figures are different for everyone.
Right, of course. So I didn't like that happened because, once again, it's not my shop. So I don't want to create problems for the shop owner. I didn't want to do that. And it sort of ended up being that way. Even the shop owner help me work on this gentleman's car because it was a serious problem with his brakes. And after we fixed it, I almost felt bad that I put the shop owner in that situation where he had to be concerned about this car that's sitting in the backyard. The person's not showing up to pay for the parts. He's not showing up to pick up his car. He's almost like kind of forgot about it sort of in a way because he knew we weren't going to charge him anymore. So it was almost like he was using us for the storage of his vehicle.
Oh. Oh
so those are the right. So those are the two things that happened, but it didn't really faze me. It doesn't matter. Bad things will happen.
Maybe. That's why you just tell them that we're going to store your car in a bad part of town.
Well, not bad experiences,
but... How many people do you estimate you've helped at this point?
I was keeping track at first, but since I've been doing this for now for months and months, I can't remember. It's been so many people. It's been so many different jobs. Sometimes I think back, like a car will come into the shop. It will be the same make and model that I worked in, and that's how I remember. I did this free service on this same car for somebody else, you know. So,
did they ever return as paying customers to the actual shop?
Yeah, surprisingly, yes. A couple of people, yes, they did come back. And what's amazing to me is people are driving from like over an hour away for service.
They trust you. That's a big thing.
I guess it is. I guess it's probably one of the most important things in business. It's your reputation.
That's what you're earning, even when you're dealing with the unsavory characters out there.
Right, exactly.
It's a learning experience. Not a bad one, right?
It is. It's absolutely a learning experience. It's also interesting to me that you kind of get the underlying problems of our society. Like the bad things that are happening, you kind of get to see it yourself, what people are affected or afflicted with.
Everybody needs to get around.
Right. Everybody needs to get around. And when you get into a tough situation, whether it's a loss of employment or drugs or whatever it is, it becomes even more difficult for people. So I helped one gentleman. He had a DUI. He lost his car. Lost his home, lost his job. He was getting himself back on track. You know, he went through the court system. I think on average it's like $10,000 to $15,000 to fight a DUI with all the fines and all that.
Yep.
So he was just getting back on his feet. He came in. I did some exhaust work for him. He was very happy, and he came back, I think a week later, and gave me $50. I said, look, I did this for free. Thank you very much. I don't need any money. He said, I want to give you this $50. I'd like you to use the money to help somebody else, the next person in a difficult situation. So absolutely, I did that. I think it was a girl next time that contacted me. I ended up buying the brake pads for her.
Oh, that's great.
That gentleman's money. So it's kind of people now almost helping other people. It's
everybody's like paying it forward.
Paying it forward.
And I hate that phrase.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool.
So you said it's been pretty much a very positive experience, and that you'd like to expand in some way.
The ultimate goal for me from this project, now that I see that I'm getting such an overwhelming positive response, and for me personally, it feels so good to be doing this. It's probably one of the best things that I've done in my life. I would love to grow this further into establishing an actual non-for-profit, so I can really help more people. Because once I'm able to accept donations, then I can really grow it as an organization. I can set up my own shop. I can set up...
your own Kickstarter, exactly. All sorts of crowdfunding. Yep, excellent.
That's the ultimate goal.
And what would be the best ways, again, for people to get a hold of you if anybody in our listening area...
Right now, the best way to get a hold of me is just to call me or text me on my phone.
Okay. And let's see. Okay. I don't mind giving out your phone
number. You can give out my phone number. Oh. I don't mind. My phone number is on the internet.
Do you want to do that?
Yeah, I don't care. It's on Craigslist. So anyone who needs help with their vehicle or somebody who wants to help with my project in terms of donating money for people, or even sometimes people donate parts, good new parts, whatever it is. My number is 917-952-7379. 917-952-7379.
Awesome. Yeah, well, I'm glad that we got in touch. That's cool.
Yeah, and hopefully that helps spread the word and gets the network started.
Thank you. That's the goal.
And if anybody calls and they're trying to mess with our new friend, you will be messing with the Catskill Maker Syndicate.
Syndicate. So, Herman, have you had to program any ECUs?
No, not part of this project. No, that's definitely okay. Something that I'm staying away from. I don't want to get involved with anything kind of major like that. No, no transmissions, no engine jobs, no timing belts, nothing like that.
You listening, everyone? That's pretty much his limit. What is your limit? What's the hardest job you've done?
You don't want to pull off an alternator to get to a serpentine belt?
No, that's no problem. That's easy stuff. Yeah, anything like that, that's doable. But just major projects that will take hours and hours, I just can't do.
Okay.
Not that I'm not willing to do so. If it was my own shop, I would gladly do it. But just because of the position that I'm in, I can't afford to have a vehicle that's staying there for a day or two.
Beggars can't be choosers, folks.
Right, exactly.
What's the hardest job you've done?
For a
on the free
job on this project? I think it'll have to be that the stepper motor, the actuator motor in the dashboard.
Ripping that dashboard apart.
Yeah, because it was a time-consuming project, absolutely. And anytime you start working on the older vehicle like that, you know, there's a potential for you to break stuff, to damage more stuff.
Wire harnesses break, right, lights come out, exactly. Switches come undone, yep.
Right. So it's, you know, it's pretty intensive to get in and take the
sun damaged plastic just cracks.
Yep.
Absolutely. I mean, plastic clips break, all that stuff. So
yeah, you can never have enough of those plastic body clips. they're all unique, too.
Absolutely.
You always need that one special spudger to get them out.
I find body clips to be a lot like screws in that only about 35% are actually required.
This is true. Yeah, you don't need every one. Yep. You just need a couple to hold the piece in place for you. That's all.
It's the hardest job you did on the clock.
Well, there is no hard job, really. Things, yeah. I don't look at it like that anymore.
Good answer.
Yeah, no, it's the truth. Anything for me is kind of easy now. So whether it's a motor swap or it's some sort of complex electrical problem, as long as you know how the system works, you can always usually figure it out. If you take it step by step, you understand, you know, what components make up the system, what usually goes wrong, you can solve anything. And when it comes to mechanical stuff, it's just a matter of nuts and bolts, right? It's like a puzzle. You have to take the puzzle apart and put it back together. That's all. So nothing really phases me anymore, and that's kind of a reason why I also want to keep going and grow this thing. I don't want to say I'm getting tired of working on cars, but it's not as challenging as it was for me before. It's like a little bit too easy now. So
nice. That's great.
Are we good, or are we?
Okay. I think that's wrapping up on that. We're coming up close to the half-hour mark. Could you just please do me one personal favor?
Sure.
And say, Russian components, American components, all parts made in Taiwan.
Pretty much everything in your life today is made in China, Taiwan, or some other Asian country. When you buy your vehicle, even if it's made, assembled in the United States or Mexico, the parts content is coming from China. That's a fact.
Oh, that's a little bit dire. Okay. Well, maybe we need a little inspiration to start working on our own cars and our own industries.
Yeah. I saw a thing about someone who's taking on Tesla and collecting, you know, broken down Teslas and kind of rigging them together. And, you know, Tesla was fighting it, too.
Were they making BattleBots?
No, he's fixing them up and putting them back on the road.
Actually, a Tesla repairman. Unsanctioned.
Unsanctioned, yeah.
Unsanctioned? You're talking about Rogue Repair?
Yeah.
I believe his name is Rich Rebuilds. He has a YouTube channel.
I've seen.
And, yep, that's what he does.
So, basically, Tesla's trying to go Edison on this guy.
No!
Edison or John Deere?
Or Hitler, Nazi-like control.
Ooh.
Oh, come on. Don't bring it back to Hitler.
Oh, we Godwin this broadcast. Shudder it.
Henry Ford? Henry Ford. We'll go halfway between. We'll just stop right there. Okay, you guys have been listening to the Thingularity Radio Program. You can contact us and have your questions answered at CatskillMakersInfo@gmail.com. You can also contact us at Thingularity.tech.
Yeah, that'll send you to our Telegram, and we've heard from Brian, who's remotely saying hello. Some people sound familiar.
Hello, Brian. That would be Brian, ex-cat wrangler, our sound technician, who is away traveling, hopefully getting us some good journalistic information and bringing it back with him.
Sure.
Okay. We got a pledge drive coming up. Just wanted to mention that so that if you guys like what you're listening to, be generous, please. We also have a special Halloween episode of Thingularity coming up on October 31st, 7 p.m. at our standard time. There may be a tentative stretching of that time. But so far, you'll be getting bonus spooky science facts. And
maybe trick-or-treaters.
Yes. Bring your trick-or-treaters. We'll be having full bars and putting them on the air. Yeah. And
Is anybody going to mind if I go back to the Tesla thing for a little bit?
Go back then.
No, go for it.
How do you guys feel about the sort of convergence of technology and old tech? The new software and the old tech of cars that Tesla represents, like where you have to use an app to
number
actually get
one
in.
My basic gripe is we take way too long to catch up with technologies that have been around for a long time. The basic components of a Tesla car, which are a battery, a regenerative braking system, and a control system, and a motor. These things have been around for a very long time. It just took fuel glut that raised prices to well over $100 a barrel for crude, and then we started pumping out Priuses. So, yeah, my main gripe is it took way too long to get to this point. These things have been around for a long time.
Yeah, well, the first car was electric, I believe, or one of the early prototypes, a couple early cars. You can see one on Jay Leno's garage.
They were fueled by all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, steam yep. cars.
Steam, combustion, gasoline.
They were all competing at one point.
And gasoline won out. Why? Because it's cheap, and it's very easy to manufacture at this point in our development as a civilization. But, yeah. So, what's going on with the Teslas? Are they keeping people from repairing them through legal action?
I don't know if it was legal action, but he was the fellow who was doing the repairs was collecting Teslas to get parts, so he would just go to
crashed Teslas, right?
Yeah, crashed, so he could get batteries or get whatever other components he would need to repair.
Salvage.
Working, yeah, he was doing salvage type of work.
Yeah, from my understanding, there's no parts available, so if you need a whatever, you just can't get it. You have to buy a new car for it.
They literally require you to send it in so that they can send it to one of their authorized repairers.
And what sort of flack did Führer Musk give to this individual?
I'm not sure.
I don't know that.
None?
Probably
not. Totally getting away with it.
Probably not on the level of John Deere.
Excellent.
Which is...
Well, that's good.
Has lost legislation recently, I believe. Or lost battles in court over whether you actually have a right to repair your own tractors and your own farm equipment.
And newsflash, you do, people. You finally do have... legally confirmed right to repair your own devices, and that includes the software. And hopefully... No? Do you disagree?
Oh, no, I was just shaking my head. It's just ridiculous that we actually had to take that to court.
Yes, it is.
That is even a question.
And that's right. Not even in every state, though. I mean, it's still being fought in California, right?
Wasn't this confirmed on a federal level?
Mm-hmm. Is it?
No, I don't think so. I think it's just a few states have finally approved right to repair.
We might have to do a little homework to get some confirmation
probably
on this.
Probably do. We have computers. Google. Somebody Google.
I think Apple is still fighting like California on the whole right to repair thing.
Yeah. The next big step in that whole war is getting them to release repair information. Basic like code and encryption data that would allow us to begin repairing these devices in the first place.
Yeah, because it's not always the hardware that's breaking. Sometimes it's just the bits that represent the software.
Yep, and then you can't just go online and download an update or reformat your devices. You have to hire a technician that is paid and authorized by John Deere, etc., to come over and repair your
devices. Well, with John Deere, it's more the parts are literally DRM. Like, you can't buy a random part. You have to buy their part.
And what would the difference between that and a patent be?
There's software on the part or on the tractor that actually prevents the non-correct part from working in the tractor.
So you're saying
mechanically it could work properly.
Yeah, it's just software locked out.
And do you mean that the software is intentionally locking itself out, or is this by some sort of mistake?
Oh, no, it's completely intentional so that you buy their parts.
Okay.
You can only use their parts.
So a planned obsolescence that really takes out perfectly working equipment.
It's kind of like, you know, there was that. There's a coffee maker that you put the little pods in.
Yeah, the Keurigs.
You can only use certain coffee pods in there because the software would detect it wasn't one of their pods and it wouldn't brew a cup of coffee.
Ah, the ones with the RFID tags in the
yeah.
Okay.
Oh. There's many other devices that require certain DRM parts too. You just, you know, can't make your own or.
What a nightmare. Okay, folks, you've been listening to the Thingularity Radio program on WGXC, ACRA, 90.7 FM, radio for open ears. Okay, now we are going to move on over to the Cody's Bio Break.
All right, for today's Bio Break, straight from the mind of the Supreme Mechanist, may I bring your attention to the 1972 World Health Organization Memoranda on Virus-Associated Immunopathology. Thanks, everyone. Located within what now must look like ancient techniques of pharmacy, venom of cobra, opening and surgical resection of organs, inoculation of active disease. Sorry, located within are what now must look like ancient techniques of pharmacy. In it, they describe a method by which they determine how it is your white blood cells know what to attack and what to leave alone. First, they look at how their experimental model, the humble mouse, among others, responds naturally to infection by viruses. Then they begin the process of elimination, usually ending in the termination of said animal's life. By breeding for immune deficiency, or by special serum injection containing snake venom, which has a known immunosuppressant effect, they look for the mechanisms of action by which you is distinguished from not you. That line is not very defined. In fact, it's so blurry you might think your eyes are wetting. They realized that there's a system of immunity called the complement system, which is a set of proteins that bind to viral particles and accumulate on the surface of cells, presenting antigens. Naturally, these concentrate at the site of infection, but are always released into the circulation of blood. Anything these circulating immune complexes of protein antigen composition implant into are essentially tagged for destruction. This includes your blood vessels, your kidneys causing necrotic inflammation. Clemens von Perkett, 1800s researcher of vitamin D fame, called it kidney eczema, and your leaky blood-brain barrier. The obvious thing to find out for these biological researchers was how to find a way around it. From page 2 of Memorandum 2, high titers of neutralizing and complement-fixing antibody were produced in the recipient carrier mice so that under these circumstances, too, the animal remained free of clinical signs. Other experiments have shown that LCM virus antibody plus complement is cytotoxic, which means that it kills the cells, for LCMV-infected cells, and tissue lesions have been detected after the injection of large amounts of antibody into carrier animals. The possible immunopathological action of antibody was suggested by finding that complement depletion by means of cobra venom made LCMV considerably less lethal for adult mice. Otherwise lethal virus became mere latent infections.
So all of that basically means that cobra venom helped keep the disease from killing them.
Not quite. It means, everybody, load up on your viruses, your bacteria, your fungi, your protozoans, and your corticosteroids. You're fine until your immune system switches back on and you drop.
From your own immune system reacting?
That is correct.
Okay. Okay, that's been our bio break. Now we're just taking an actual bio break.
I came back, okay, my car was gone. Well, I didn't know it was.
Okay, and we are back. All right, Chris, do you have anything interesting to talk about from the news culled from around the interwebs?
No. Nothing.
Nothing at all.
What is it?
Sam? You're worthless.
What's that noise? How about...
Thank you.
Russia refusing to tell NASA what caused the mystery leak on ISIS, or on ISS.
Yes, the mystery continues.
Weren't they the ones to report it, though?
Okay,
were they the ones to report it?
No, somebody found a hole.
Yeah, there was a hole drilled straight through one of their craft.
I thought it was reported by a cosmonaut that they found this hole drilled originally.
So they say they know how it happened, but they're not going to tell us. Some things have to be secret.
They checked it out. They took samples. They patched it up with space duct tape, literally. And
what else would you use in space?
Just
regular
base doctor? JB Weld? I don't know.
Oh,
yeah, JB Weld.
We have a master class on that, by the way.
But yeah, once they patched that up, they're like, it's our secrets. I mean,
some things must remain unknowable.
Are there photos of this hole?
Yeah, there actually are. Yeah? And you can even see
is there a burr? Like, you can tell if it's drilled?
There's a burr. And there's a small, strip where if you're ever drilling something and drill slips, and you know what this looks like.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You just see that little line right next to the hole.
that's just the
telltale sign that you screwed up. You didn't pay attention. Well, it happens. You know, it happens to the best of us. And apparently it happened to the best of the best, because somebody drilled in a spot that they don't know of and didn't report. And it was only found.
It was already in space, right?
Yes. They believe it was already in space. There were conspiracy theories that somebody wanted to get out of the space station and leave early.
That seems like a sane way to do it.
Well, you know, if the safety.
I want to be liquefied and sucked out like through a straw.
Well,
drill a tiny hole to escape in that case.
Okay, it's not quite like it is in the movies. If you put a hole in the space station or in a plane like that, you're not going to get sucked out like spaghetti. It's going to take a lot of pressure.
Not?
No, not quite. If you put your hand over the hole, you're pretty much stopping it. I mean, you're going to get a blister.
It's not like the Play-Doh Fun Factory.
It's extrude you out the hole.
No,
well, it's only
unfortunately.
At 14.7 PSI or whatever, so if it's a tiny little hole, you're probably blocking a few pounds total force.
You won't even get a blister.
Yeah. You need a lot more pressure and a little bit of a bigger hole.
What else do we have over there? Oh, sorry.
Quiet Russians.
I don't think it was even Russians. I think it was sabotaged by American astronauts, I believe.
Well, the Russians say they know how it was done, though.
Exactly.
Maybe they watched the American do it. Maybe it was a bet. Maybe they brought some vodka and made a bit of a bet. Had a bit of fun.
Yeah, they're just keeping quiet because of the Astro Bro code.
What if somebody had some form of contraband and needed a really discreet way of getting rid of it?
Do they have contraband checks?
Pole size
space station?
Contraband?
Well, considering it's $10,000 a pound to get something up there, I'd assume there's a contraband check.
I would imagine they check before you get on the rocket.
You do have a personal allotment of certain things you can bring, and Russians do bring vodka to the space station.
There's probably a whole size storage space for that contraband.
Yeah, my tummy. Okay, what else we got in the news?
Who wants something? Somebody.
I don't know. I was going to talk about packaging for a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead.
Let's talk about packaging.
You guys ever do any packaging for Linux? Anybody?
Oh, so not packaging like we're sending cookies to grandma.
No.
No, like software packaging where you compress files and add a little bit of metadata.
And then you can decompress them on your system, and all of a sudden you have an installed application with a menu entry and maybe some meme data that it can open certain file types.
For people using more or less standard operating systems, how would this go about happening?
The packaging or unpacking?
Obtaining one of these and deploying it.
Oh, you go to someone's webpage usually and download one of these things?
And that's for Windows?
Yeah, for Windows. For Mac OS, you could download, app bundles. For Linux, you have several choices, which is kind of what I want to talk about.
Depending on your flavor. What flavors would you like to talk about today?
Well, it's actually not. So you have, the native flavor, and then you have these not native things, Snap, and you have Flatpak or AppImage. So, the native package manager could be like DPKG if you're using Debian, or like Pac-Man if you're using Arch. And they're just basically a distribution-specific way to pack up the software. So they have these other ones like Flatpak and Snap, AppImage. They're supposed to solve this problem of distributing across distributions, right? So
what you're saying is a universal sort of package.
Yeah.
You're not dependent on one single file type, like a deb, a deep package. DPKG, as you said, Pac-Man is .pkg. Those are all incompatible across distros, right?
Yeah, you can't build an installer generally on Debian and install it on like another Linux.
And that's a general, right? Because there are some utilities that can cross.
Well, let's say anything's possible, but it's not really worth it to get there.
I've actually used RPM on Packers.
You can
work just fine.
You can, but what happens when you use things like Alien is you'll break dependency checks, or you'll break stuff where it is doing something specific that the other package manager can't do. So
Flatpak and what was the other one? AppImage. They all solve those problems, right?
Sort of. So there's three different competing ones. There's AppImage, there's Snap, and there is Flatpak. Flatpak is by the free desktop people. Snap is done by Canonical, and I'm not sure if there's actually a group behind AppImage. But basically what they're trying to solve is that cross-distro... It might be. That cross-distro distribution. So right now, if you're running a Linux distribution and you have, let's say, a version of a software, you'll get an update from your repository, and you'll just update that software. If you want to keep it at a specific version, it becomes a little trickier. Or if you want to get one where libraries
are a
certain version, that's a problem they're trying to solve. The interesting way of doing it is like the Flatpak stuff is interesting because it creates like a shadow system, which I really don't like.
System? Is that like a shadow government?
Yeah, kind of. It actually installs everything to user local, which is...
The local? I never have to go in that folder.
You shouldn't. No one should ever go there.
So do you mean it self-contains everything that it installs?
Yeah, it has nothing to do with your host system, which really kind of is a bummer, because if you want to install a small application, you might pull, like, gigabytes of dependencies to do that through Flatpak. Which is unfortunate, because the native package might be a megabyte or two.
Right, but you'll still have those dependencies, won't you?
Yes.
The dependencies will be covered, but you'll be eating up so much file space unnecessarily.
Yeah, so recently I had one single Flatpak installed for some application that I was testing. And once everything was removed, the platform tooling was something like 45 gigs left over of just random stuff.
See, you're touching on what's kind of one of the best fundamental differences between Linux and most of the other operating systems. Shared libraries that effectively work together.
I guess if you don't run Linux, you probably don't understand that to the extent that I would take it for granted.
Linux machines need a lot less space to do the same thing because a lot of the software uses overlapping libraries and bits of data.
Yeah, the system is more tightly coupled together. Like on a Windows system, you have like the base stuff Microsoft provides, and they'll provide a dozen versions of it just so that old software continues to work. But you'll also have to install everything else that's not provided by them. Whereas on like a normal Linux distribution, a lot of that stuff is installed. So if you install an application, you're just installing that application's code, which usually isn't too large.
And if you don't have something it depends on, you pull automatically, and that's another, you know, couple megabytes or whatever.
Yeah. So the thing that these new systems are trying to solve is like some distributions move a lot faster than others. Like Arch, basically the day it hits upstream, 2 days later it's in Arch. Debian, it could be, is it unfair to say several years?
No, it's not at all. Debian takes a while. It is what's called a stable system.
Yes.
And it waits for software to be well vetted for over a year.
But what about Debian unstable?
You can add that to your apt list if you want.
Yeah.
You can. What happens to your system?
Probably nothing. I use Debian for like web servers and stuff like that, just for
reliability.
Reliability, yeah. It doesn't need to do anything fancy. It just has to run run Apache or run Nginx.
You don't install any snaps on those bad boys?
No snaps.
No flat packs? No app images?
No flat packs. No.
All software cheap. Installed directly from the repos.
Yeah, cheap servers that are dedicated to one purpose. That's it.
You guys ever use snaps at all?
So are these things, they're just kind of like cheap hacks, right?
Yeah.
You just, you do a loopback file system, and then when you run the actual application you want, it just...
Yeah, that's the
points to that loopback file that's system.
Doesn't that come with extra overhead?
Oh, yeah, a lot of extra overhead. If you run a snap or a flatpak or an app image compared to, like, a natively installed application, there's a noticeable startup because it has to mount the application. It actually acts to unzip sometimes, uncompress the application, then mount it, then load everything into memory, and then run it. Whereas if it's natively installed, it just loads it into memory, and it can start running it.
Interesting.
And how did it end up wasting 40 gigs on your hard drive?
Well, because I had GNOME platform tools and KDE platform tools and some SDK stuff. And when I removed the application, well, I was developing. So when I removed the application, it didn't take any of the dependencies with it. So the shadow system ended up, you know, having a really bad cleanup.
So really, you got this Flatpak. It didn't have everything packaged in the Flatpak?
Well, that's not how Flatpaks work.
Oh.
Flatpak actually requires you install a repository to get your Flatpaks from. And Flatpaks depend on other Flatpaks, which is a similar system for snaps. The one that's different is app images, where app image actually takes the approach that Apple takes with making app bundles.
Yeah.
And they take everything and they compress it into a folder, all of everything down to glibc.
Well, so you know what a Flatpak sounds like to me? Putting another package system on top of your existing packaging system.
That's my main gripe with Flatpak and Snap.
Do you mean software with extra steps?
Well, no, it's not extra steps because you can install Flatpak or Snap through your package manager. The thing is, you don't know you're installing them.
But you could use your package manager to install the software, so that is an extra step.
Well, you would install your native software the same way.
You could have just installed GNOME and your SDKs with your normal package manager, couldn't you have?
Yes, except my distribution didn't have the specific version I was looking for. And that's what the Flatpak tries to solve. But if you do it with app images, you get all the bundle.
So it made a big mess and forgot to clean up.
Yep.
Well, that's lovely. It sounds like a lot of software problems, and hopefully it just sticks to digital realm. Okay, we're moving on to our history section with Corey.
Okay, this month in science history for October, on the 1st, 1908, the Ford Model T, first car model made via assembly line, was sold to the public at the price of $825. 1957, a little bit of a horrific news for this month, thalidomide was released in Western Germany and soon sold in nearly 50 countries as a wonder drug to combat morning sickness in expectant mothers. Unfortunately, it affected the growth of the fetus, leading over to 10,000 cases worldwide of birth defects. October 2nd, 1608, lens grinder Johannes Lippershey demonstrated the first optical refracting telescope, the prototype for the modern telescopes. October 3rd, the first successful video recording onto magnetic tape of black and white recordings was made at Bing Crosby Enterprises, Inc. in L.A. To October 4th, 1957, the Soviet Union launched Sputnik, the first man-made satellite, into orbit for 3 months. October 6th, 1956, Dr. Albert Sabin announced his oral polio vaccine was ready for international testing.
Which, by the way... gave a lot of
people
Simian Virus
40. Oh. October 9th, 1876, Alexander Graham Bell and Thomas Watson had the first two-way telephone conversation in Boston. October 12th, 1928, a polio-stricken girl at Children's Hospital in Boston was the first patient to use the iron lung.
In case you didn't hear me, that polio shot,
mm-hmm.
the oral vaccine, sometimes it gave people active polio viruses or simian virus 40, which they knew that they couldn't strain from the monkeys that they harvested it from, which is a known oncovirus, cancer-causing virus.
Damn. Okay.
wasn't a dead vaccine. Was it just a hand?
Oh, and even if it was dead, the Simian Virus 40 is still there.
October 13th, 1914, Garrett Morgan invented and patented the gas mask. October 14th, 1947, Chuck Yeager broke through the sound barrier over Muir Dry Lake, California, in his rocket-powered Bell XS-1. And October 16th, 1916, Margaret Sanger and her sister Ethel Byrne and associate Fania Medell opened the first U.S. birth control clinic in Brooklyn. Clinic was closed by police, and Sanger received a 30-day jail sentence. Then went on to help organize the National Birth Control League, which evolved into Planned Parenthood Federation of America.
Weren't they also involved in, or the set? Well, wasn't Margaret Sanger also involved in the establishment of eugenics?
I don't know about that. Actually, I may have heard about. It sounds a little familiar. Of course, a lot. That was
my
just
hero.
Wow. A lot of people were, you know, involved, or at least, you know, interested in it at that time.
Yep.
Yep. Okay. I was about to say, given the time frame, you know. October 18th, 1922, the British Broadcasting Company was founded by John Wraith. 5 years later, it was granted its first royal charter and redubbed the British Broadcasting Corporation. 1955, the antiproton was discovered at UC Berkeley through the use of the Bevatron. 1971, the newly founded EPA took its first action, shutting down heavy industries in Birmingham due to toxic levels of air pollution. October 19th, 1973, federal judge issued a decision invalidating the ENIAC patent, belatedly crediting physicist John Tanasoff for developing the first electronic digital computer. October 22nd, André Jacques Gernandt made the first successful parachute jump from a balloon released over 2,000 feet in Paris. Due to lack of a vent, he also suffered the first case of air sickness. 1981, the FDA approved aspartame artificial sweetener, and several years later, G.D. Seal marketed it as NutraSweet. And, yeah, let's
aspartame.
See. Finally, on October 31st, I think this came up last month, 1992, Pope John Paul II reversed the Roman Inquisition's guilty verdict against Galileo Galilei for the heresy of declaring the earth revolves around the sun.
And when was that again? 1992.
Yep, so about like, yeah, 1992, about like, what, over 300 years later? 400?
Yeah, that's 16 or 17.
And I think that was this month's in sign history.
Yeah. Didn't we have last month a really old apology, too?
Yeah. Because, yeah, I think that was, yeah, last month was when, you know, I think, you know, the actual original decision against him, you know, guilty was, you know, made.
Takes a long time for the church to get around to.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Nah, that's cool. Like,
apparently several hundred years.
Yeah. A biblical time frame.
That's a good way to put it.
Okay, anybody have any last things to wrap up with? Or
yeah.
What we got here?
Speaking of eugenics, which I don't really want to talk about, but a fellow who was involved in that, an early geneticist, a man by the name of Ronald Fisher, actually, he's credited with modern statistics. He's the father of modern stats. So you hear a lot of statistics in the news and whatnot. Well, this guy came up with a lot of the concepts, and his early inspiration was he had a friend, a professor friend, who had a friend. You know, so a friend of a friend claimed that she could tell, they're English people, by the way, British, that she claimed that she could tell whether or not milk had been poured into tea or if tea had been poured into the milk. Right? So apparently there's a difference in flavor. Mm-hmm. And this mathematician was like, well, I don't know if this is really true. So he wanted to figure out a fair way to take out the luck, I guess, of somebody just guessing correctly. And he came up with the property, something known as variance, which gets used a lot in statistics. But he devised this experiment where he said, I'm going to make 8 cups of coffee, or tea, sorry. I drink a lot of coffee, not tea. So he made 8 cups of tea. 4 of them had milk added after the tea had been poured. 4 had the milk poured first and the tea added afterwards. And she guessed all 8 of them correctly, actually, which has a 1 in 70 probability of occurring.
If you're guessing randomly.
If you're guessing randomly, there's a 1 in 70 chance that you would correctly guess all 8 cups. And she could do this consistently, so
I would kind of like to add to this that that does make perfectly good sense to me. I have heard of this before, and there's actually a custom that goes along with that. You see, if the coffee or tea is too hot, it can actually start to curdle the milk if it's poured in and mixed too quickly. So what you want to do is take the coffee or tea and pour that into the milk, thus cooling it off slowly, blending the temperatures a little bit better. And I could actually see definitely some chemical reactions occurring one way and not the other. So, great. All right. Okay, you guys have been listening to the Thingularity Radio program here on WGXC. I'd like to thank our guest, Herman the Crazy Russian. Herman, would you like to give out your contact information one more time?
Sure, absolutely. My number is 917-952-7379. If you know someone or you have someone in your family that needs help working on their vehicle and they're down and out or they don't have a lot of money, you're welcome to give me a call and I'll help them out.
That's a good guy, folks. And don't forget, that number is also available if you want to call and help out or offer your work. Also, our contact information, if you want to get a hold of us and ask any questions between now and the next show, our information is CatskillMakersInfo@gmail.com. You can also get a hold of us using our Telegram channel at thingularity.tech. Okay, that's it for today. You're going to catch us next on Halloween. We'll be having a special show, which will be during the pledge drive, so be sure to have those checkbooks ready. Bring your kids on down to the Makers. We're located at 65 West Bridge Street. We will be giving out candy and having some people welcome on the radio. All right, that is it for tonight. Everybody, remember, there is no such thing as a failed experiment.
We also might have a giveaway. You never know.
Mm-hmm. Good?
Yeah.
Very nice.